again to Principles of Environmental Toxicology. Today's lecture, Teratogenesis, Mutagenesis, and Carcinogenesis, is perhaps one of the more complex biological, biophysical discussions that we will have this semester. What we've tried to do in this particular segment of the course is take all of those toxic endpoints that relate to genetic mutations, to things involving the molecules of life, and put them together. So not because it's seamless, but because the endpoints have similarities and there is a potential for crossover in terms of a toxicant-induced disruption in the molecules of life. What differentiates several of the endpoints that we'll be discussing today is that, in fact, some of those endpoints, the toxicosis, if you will, is inheritable from parent to child. And this has to do with changes or mutations in the genetic code. This differentiates it from the more acute or chronic sorts of toxicoses that we were talking about before. Our learning objectives here today, what we're going to try to have you do is be able to define teratogenesis, mutagenesis, and carcinogenesis. Long words all, but each with their own independent and specific meaning. We're going to have you describe the relevance of replication, transcription, and translation. How these terms, how these processes, which you've introduced several times in the course, and we've introduced them at a fairly low level. Again, this is not a molecular biology course. This is not a genetics course. We're trying to give you sufficient background that you can understand through the tools of biology what you need to know to talk about toxicology, the interface of chemistry and biology. We'll describe the relevance of these terms as it relates to teratogenesis, mutagenesis, and carcinogenesis. I'm going to have you try to summarize the mechanism of action of these three toxic endpoints, teratogenesis, mutagenesis, and carcinogenesis. And we'll try to discuss some examples of known teratogens, mutagens, and carcinogens. You'll do this not only through some of the lecture materials that we'll discuss here this morning, but we will also have you do it through your readings, primarily the readings in the used textbook. Well, where do we start? Well, as I introduced, these three interactions, these three endpoints, have to do with the molecules of life. What we find is that chemically reactive toxicants can react or modify these other chemicals, these molecules, DNA and RNA. This can have the endpoint of leading to these heritable changes in the offspring or changes in cellular growth and development, leading to perhaps uncontrolled cellular growth and development, such as carcinogenesis. What we found in previous discussions is that replication, this process in the nucleus, perpetuates genetic information. And so disruptions at that point in replication, in terms of cell division, can in fact lead to these heritable changes. Another aspect in terms of the disposition of the molecules of life is transcription and translation. These two tools are used to express genetic information, primarily in terms of the chemicals and primarily proteins that are involved in many enzymatic and antibody functions, which we'll discuss. Now, this is a cartoon that we've tried to reduce a more complex diagrammatic illustration of the cell in terms of the three sequential processes of replication, transcription, and translation. Replication happening within the nucleus, transcription, translation happening in terms of the ribosomes and in the cytosol, forming proteins. Now, in terms of these proteins and why these mutations or these changes or disruptions in replication, transcription, and translation might have outcome, it has much to do not only with whether or not the conceptus can actually survive, but also whether or not there is a significant mutation leading to some functional change in perhaps proteins. Reviewing once again protein functions, they can function as antibodies where they recognize molecules of invading organisms, as receptors where they essentially recognize various chemicals or other hormones and actually inform the cell or transmit information. Proteins can function as enzymes where they assemble or digest. We've seen that they can be neurotransmitters or hormones or enzymes. They can actually cascade responses. We can also have proteins that provide structural channels in pores. Different proteins are used in assembling different macrostructures in the body, we can then have a genetic display of teratogenesis or a malformation of the conceptus. These three endpoints that we're going to discuss today, teratogenesis is defined as the origin or production of a malformed fetus or offspring, whereas mutagenesis is defined as production of a mutation. This is a chemical mutation or a change in the genetic code of an organism. Now, we can have low-level mutagenesis that can be repaired. Just like we can have low-level carcinogenesis or the generation of neoplastic cells, these new cells that are managed by our immune system. Mutations can be managed by repair enzymes. And so this sequence of events, mutagenesis and carcinogenesis primarily, can be a part of normal physiological function at low levels. One might also argue from an evolutionary point of view that mutagenesis makes us who we are, that successful mutations perhaps lead to genetic anomalies like the world's fastest human, the ability to sprint very fast, run very fast, people that have specific individual skills. If you look out in the natural kingdom in terms of selection of species, mutation might also have been a strong part of this in terms of selective adaptation to an individual or species environment. Carcinogenesis is best defined as cancer formation, and this includes carcinoma and malignant neoplasms. What we will do as a part of this lecture is go through the lexicon of carcinogenesis, give you some terminology to differentiate the various terms, clinical terms, and also biological terms that are associated with the onset and development of cancer. Now, we've talked about the impact of chemicals with the molecules of life. Recall that in DNA replication that we have a molecule, and this molecule, once we kind of figured it out, once we decoded this coding action of DNA, we can see that in fact it implies replication. We find in terms of our analysis of molecular biology that this occurs via multiple enzyme interactions, so there's a certain orchestration, a concert symphony, if you will, of these molecules of life. The helix unravels, the strands part, and DNA replicates. DNA replication is important in mitosis and meiosis, and those who remember their high school and college biology will discuss this a little bit. Unfortunately, as we find out, this is not always a perfect process. There are repair enzymes to sense and detect and repair problems associated with genes or gene disruption in the DNA molecule. Now, in replication, we find that this process is what duplicates cell DNA. In mitosis, it's a somatic cell process. One somatic cell, it has two N chromosomes, and we'll detail those on karyotypes here in a moment. It divides to create two new cells with two N chromosomes. So this is a duplication. Okay, and in humans, that N is equal to 23, so 2N is equal to 46 chromosomes. Now, in terms of this replication, the number, quality, and quantity of the chromosomes per cell is conserved. And so we can find that some disruption in the number, the quality, or the quantity of those chromosomes can actually be a mutagenic effect. What we find is that the triggers for mitosis is a combination of receptors and proteins. They can be external signals, they can be hormones, they can be internal factors or growth factors that essentially initiate this cascade of response. In your biology books, you've probably seen micrographs of mitosis in cells duplicating each other. In meiosis, this is a process of sexual reproduction. These are with germ cells that divide into gametes. This is responsible for the genetic variation because we have two cell divisions. We end up with four daughter cells. We start off with diploids and end up with haploids. Each of these have a different set of chromosomes, and this is what gives us the potential for a high degree of genetic variability. If you look among your siblings, you might notice different color hair, different heights, different body weights, body composition. This is in essence the genetic variability from meiosis. Each of these have one set that will be joined by another set in fertilization, and so now you have external genetic information in terms of sexual reproduction coming in to join the fertilized embryo. In DNA transcription, we find that very simply DNA is copied via an expendable messenger RNA. This messenger RNA codes for specific proteins. This occurs in the nucleus of the cell. The next step is DNA translation. This occurs in the cytosol. And this is by an interaction of messenger RNA, transfer RNA, and various amino acids and enzymes in terms of this assembly process. This is the factory, so to speak, of all of the proteins as the proteins are coded by translated DNA. Transfer RNA has three base codons, and I always like to think of codons as the root word code. In a certain sense, we have a map, a formula, a schematic, if you will. And it's very interesting in terms of looking at this chemistry, this assembly chemistry, and the drivers for this assembly chemistry in terms of the configurations of the amino acids, the configurations of the nucleotides that allow for coding for these amino acids, all of this being, again, an incredible symphony of life. These amino acids are added one at a time enzymatically. Messenger RNA helps, transfer RNA helps shuttle these amino acids around to allow for this assembly. They form these chains, short chains of amino acids called polypeptides. These polypeptides get longer and grow into proteins. They have a specific amino acid sequence. In the book, there's a good cartoon on the internet. There's many resources in terms of animations, looking at various cell assembly animations. If you need to refresh your high school and entry-level biology in terms of DNA translation, I suggest that you actually seek out these resources. Now, in transcription and translation, remember that DNA is a double strand of nucleotides. These nucleotides are combined from our nucleic acids, sugar and phosphates. These nucleic acids, including cytosine, thymine, uracil, adenine, and guanine, C, T, U, A, and G, allow, in terms of the double helix, for base pairing. This base pairing is a hydrogen bonding phenomenon, so it allows for a base pair, for instance, between adenine and thymine, or AT, guanine, cytosine, GC. This has been represented in many high school books, and you'll see it here in a moment in terms of our representation. Now, in terms of some more definitions, gene is just a sequence of bases that code for a specific sequence of amino acids. So it codes for a protein, the sequence of polypeptides building to a protein. This code or codon is actually a sequence of three bases, and these three bases code for a single amino acid. So, for example, adenine, guanine, cytosine will be the code for serine. And so when we read in media reports about they have cracked the human genetic code or some other animal, what we find is they have actually have an idea of the sequences of bases in the human genome. And so we know what they code for. We don't necessarily know the next step is what all of these genes actually do in terms of deciphering the relationship of these structures to human formation, to human disease, human metabolism. One of the things that you should note at this point in time, and the used textbook does a good job of this, is that there can be problems in terms of toxic potential even at this step. If, for example, we have a miscoding, sometimes we can have a misstep in terms of the next stage of translation. Remember also that transcription is equivalent to a copying process where DNA unzips and enzymes make an RNA copy. The differences between DNA and RNA have to do with thymine is transferred for uracil, so we have a UA, not an RTA in terms of the base pairing. And instead of the deoxyribose sugar, we have ribose. In messenger RNA formation, we have this molecule, this biomolecule, functioning to transport this now to the cytoplasm. The next step is translation. This is the protein formation, important process. We can have disruption of the codons. We can have false amino acids come in. False keys in our key lock arrangement in terms of the coding. These can yield undesirable toxic outcomes. The messenger RNA is simply thought about as a blueprint, whereas the ribosomal RNA is more of a support transfer RNA. Transfer RNA actually transports the amino acids prior to assembly. Now, in terms of the structure and function relationships available in DNA, these nucleotides form chains, and so these chains form a double helix, as you can kind of see in the diagram below. Three nucleotides form a codon. Multiple codons will come together to form a gene. These genes form chromosomes, and multiple chromosomes form DNA. And so that's the growth basis from smaller to larger in terms of the relationship of nucleotides to DNA. This gives you an idea, an image. Again, I always like to remind biologists that fundamentally we're talking about chemistry and biochemistry, that these assemblies of molecules are just assemblies of atoms. Atoms are assemblies of particles and charge disposition. It all comes down to thermodynamics and kinetics in terms of what can react. But it's important to note that these are reactive molecules, and in fact there are many points on this chemical double helix that can be reports, actually sites of direct toxic impact. The idea is that there needs to be not only the potential for chemical or functional group interaction in terms of reactivity, but also molecular configuration. What do we have when we have a double helix? Think of it again as a twisted ladder with many steps. And so there are certain size molecules and certain reactive sites on molecules that can interact with DNA, that can interact with RNA, and have this impact on these molecules of life. Some of the impacts have to do with natural causes. Not everything is a toxic impact. Things just go bad. This is a very complex orchestra, and if you've ever been to the symphony or to a concert, occasionally you'll hear one of the players play out of tune. It just happens. There is an error rate. There can be errors in base pairing. There can be some response to that in terms of repair enzymes and other enzymes. There's a whole symphony of regulatory genes, operons, which are genes that essentially control genetic replication. And there can be termination sequences to essentially turn off cellular replication, essentially saying, we're done. We don't go on forever. You can imagine that interactions or problems with termination sequences are also a problem with cell apoptosis, this programmed cell death that is apparently not functional in cancer genes. We can have some change in methylation patterns in terms of DNA nucleotides. We can have also some problems associated with post-transcriptional, translational processing in terms of DNA replication. There can be some chemical interactions, so we have direct interactions between endogenous or exogenous chemicals. We can find that we can have alkylation, covalent adducts that are formed between DNA and some sort of chemical. If you recall, some of the World War I mustard gases introduced as being kind of a toxic chemical warfare agent. Not only were these acute toxicants, but they were also alkylating agents, such that if you survive the initial toxicosis, you may actually have had some long-term problems with mutagenesis, carcinogenesis from these very strong mustard alkylating agents. We can have a process of intercalation. This is a non-covalent binding of some sort of chemical between two adjacent base pairs. I've put a chemical representation up here on this slide. This is ethidium. Those of you that have ever worked in a molecular biology lab have worked with gel electrophoresis, know of ethidium dibromide, which is a chemical that is used in that process. On the bottle in the laboratory, it's always marked caution mutagenic chemical. One of the reasons it's mutagenic is because it has this intercalation. It actually just fits quite well. It's a somewhat planar molecule. There's some hydrogen bonding that occurs, and so this is not a covalent bonding. And because we now have changed the form and function of DNA, we have the potential for mutation. We can have cross-linkage, and this is where we have a inter or intra-strand covalent binding of a chemical. So you remember that your nucleotides have reactive functional groups, nitrogens, we have oxygens in there. There is a potential that those reactive sites can get covalently bound by various reactive chemicals, and we'll see one here in a moment. We can have some sort of breakage, scission or of one or both strands of DNA, and this can be just a very reactive chemical. Quite often this can be something, for example, like a free radical that just breaks a chain. DNA strand breaks are a potential source of mutagenesis. This gives you an example of a covalently bound DNA adduct. This is aflatoxin B1. This is a mycotoxin coming from the Aspergillus mycotoxin found, for example, in peanuts, sometimes in some areas of the world, in milk as well. You can see here on a molecular basis that the aflatoxin can bind a guanine residue at the nitrogen residue here. How this kind of looks in terms of the full disposition of the DNA adduct, you notice that this is now bound and has this covalently bound. And covalent binding is due to energetics. It can be reversed, but typically it will require energy to be reversed. And that energy may come from enzymatic action repair chemistry that happens to DNA. This is probably the cause, the mechanistic cause in terms of the carcinogenicity of aflatoxins. We're going to switch over now to the second stage of the interaction of toxicology in the molecules of life, and this is teratogenesis. Teratogenesis is more of the outcome rather than perhaps the process. It's the study of the frequency, causation, and development of congenital malformations. There's typically a complex mechanism and timing of some of the disruptive actions. These actions typically will happen during critical stages of embryogenesis. There are some natural bad path spontaneous abortions in humans. This rate is estimated to be 15% to 20% of all conceptions are actually end up in these spontaneous natural abortions. In humans, the time in embryogenesis that is most critical is the first 8 weeks of gestation. In the textbook and in other resources, you can see that there are certain developmental processes. Again, I'll go back to the example of a symphony. Things have to happen with a certain amount of harmony and timing. And if there is a potential toxication happening at a critical time, we can end up with some of these bad paths. Some of these can lead to spontaneous abortion or, in some cases, teratogenesis. This happens during exposure of the conceptus, during the embryonic stage. It can lead to morphological defects in terms of cell differentiation in specialized tissues and organs. Typically, we associate teratogenesis with fetal stage exposure, and this is why if you're a pregnant mom or a reproductive age female, there is great concern in terms of the potential exposure of you to potential toxicants, whether they be specific in terms of teratogenesis or specific in terms of potential neurological development or delayed neurological development. We do have a list of known human teratogens. Typically, when we know a chemical is teratogenic, it's because of an extraordinarily bad experience. Again, the used textbook goes through a few of these. They're unfortunate parts of human history, particularly devastating because we have great empathy for the individuals that have survived this, as well as the conceptus that don't survive. An example in terms of teratogenesis, this is deformed offspring. Sometimes they survive, sometimes they don't. It depends upon how significant the malformation is. The correct clinical term for the offspring is actually monster. This is not something out of the movies or something to joke about. That the monster development is, again, a clinical term in terms of teratogens and deformed conceptus. In this particular case, it's a five-legged frog. This is a significant teratogenesis in terms of limb development. This was actually back in the mid-90s. Many of you may have read of this episode. It was a grade school class, I believe in Minnesota, that was out doing an ecological investigation of some local ponds and waterways. They were looking at tadpoles and frogs and noticed a few too many deformed frogs. And in terms of a grade school class, these would attract a significant amount of attention, and perhaps it attracted even more attention in terms of the scientific community. In terms of media analysis of this, because of the way it happened, there's always a great concern that there is some chemical X out in the environment. If it's doing this to frogs, what's it doing to my kids, or potentially doing to my kids in terms of mutations? A significant amount of alarm in the media. When the ecologists and the environmental toxicologists actually went in and did a thorough workup, we actually found that the causative factor was infectious, not chemical. There was a particular parasitic fluke that was infesting this and these animals during the embryonic stages and causing these malformations. There was obviously a whole cascade of effect, and in terms of a linkage to pollution, there is at least an assessment that enhanced nutrients may have been the cause in terms of enhancing the life cycle of these parasites and having a higher organism impact in terms of teratogenesis. This picture here is ovine cyclopia. This is obviously a devastating teratogenesis to sheep. It comes from animals that graze in the early periods of gestation on Veratrum californicum or false heliobore. False heliobore has some steroidal amines that will yield this particular teratogenesis in their lambs. This is a naturally occurring teratogen. Many of you have perhaps, even in the western U.S., if you go into a wet area in some of your hikes, you might see a false heliobore, sometimes referred to as skunk cabbage, growing in wet areas. It's got a tube. There is a starchy root associated with this, and if grazed upon, again in certain levels at certain stages in terms of pregnancy, you can end up with this particular disposition of teratogenesis. This is another case of a natural plant toxin. These are quinolizidin alkaloids from the anhygyrene type chemicals. They're found in lupins. Many of us have gone hiking in the early spring and seen fairly large scale fields of purple or blue lupins covering the hillside. They're very beautiful, but they have the potential for toxicity as teratogenesis. The disposition of this particular of anhygyrene is in livestock called crooked calf disease. What we find is this bowed formation. There's an arch in the back. Animals exposed to this particular alkaloid in utero actually can survive. It's a difficult life, I'm sure, as this animal is at least several years old. But there's a specific sort of disposition in terms of teratogenesis. It's structural anomaly in terms of a bowed back and a bowing of the forelimbs. Particularly tragic case study I've talked about here. This is with humans in terms of lupin alkaloid birth defects. This was in 1980. There was a baby boy born in a backcountry, Trinity County, in Northern California. It was brought to the UC Medical Center in Sacramento with had severe bone deformities in his arms and hands, and a partial absence of forearm bones and absent thumbs. Obviously, the physicians there gave an extensive medical history workup and genetic analyses. The parents indicated that it wasn't hereditary in terms of genetic. It's probably some sort of environmental exposure. In terms of a follow-up workup of what might be happening, the parents were worried about herbicide spraying that happened in some of the forests nearby. There had been some linkage in terms of various modes of toxicity with these herbicides. There was some concern in terms of dose and potential response. There was also some evidence presented that this particular family raised goats and drank their own goat milk, and that in fact there was a analysis of the dogs on their particular property that were also exposed to goat milk that also had this same pattern of bone deformity. The goat milk in that area can be impacted as any natural grazing impact in terms of the plant kingdom. Alpine lupin is a fairly common species in the area. At University of California, Davis, they actually did some controlled studies with mountain lupin to determine that in fact significant amounts of the anhygyrene can actually show up in goat's milk, a particularly tragic case in terms of teratogenesis. Our next step that we're going to talk about here today on our trifecta is mutagenesis. Mutagenesis involves somatic cell mutations. When we have yielding some sort of metabolic dysfunction, sometimes this can also yield carcinogenesis. And so this is the relationship between a cell mutation or mutation in the genetic code and carcinogenesis. In germ cell mutation, this is when a mutation can have this heritable change that we introduced. It can be a point mutation, so we can find that there is a base substitution. This can include base analogs. For example, there are some toxic mushrooms that provide analog bases as a mode of their toxicity. What this does is has a cascading effect in terms of protein synthesis. There's another one that can be, for example, defined as a frame shift, and the used textbook discusses this quite well. We can also have a chromosomal aberration, and this can be an anomaly in the structure of the chromosome. This can be because of, for example, a mutation that is developed from a chemical reaction. There can also be a numerical anomaly where we just don't have that key critical number of chromosomes in terms of reproduction. One of the ways we do an analysis of chromosomes is by the use of karyotypes. Because chromosomes are microscopically visible, we can actually separate them, align them, and examine their patterns, count them out, looking in terms of genetic analysis. So here, as I said, we have 23 pairs. This is a typical human karyotype, XY, so this is a male karyotype. These XY, XX chromosomes down here are responsible for secondary sexual characteristics. In terms of aberrations, when we look for genetic aberrations, in terms of the number or the structure, we can find aneuploidy or polyploidy. And this can be either the loss or gain of complete chromosomes. These analyses in terms of chromosomal workup are visible once again, and this is, for example, when a pregnant mom goes through amniocentesis in terms of looking for potential genetic defects of the conceptus. These are some of the sorts of analyses that are done. Down syndrome is 47, so there's an extra chromosome. It's a 21 plus, and so instead of two chromosomes here, there would be a third one. Klinefelter's syndrome, which is a secondary sexual characteristic syndrome, is in the XY, and so instead of an XY, you have an XXY. The Turner syndrome is an XO monosomy. So there is no second chromosome. We have only an X chromosome, no Y, no second X. These are all survivable aberrations in terms of chromosomal makeup. They do yield a significant change in the offspring from this genetic variation. One of the ways that we actually look at chemicals in terms of trying to find out if in fact they are mutagenic, they have the ability to change the molecules of life, is using the Ames test for chemical mutagenicity. The Ames test is wonderful because of its simplicity and its ability to screen significant numbers of chemicals and their metabolites for potential mutagenicity. Quite often when you see that a chemical is regarded as mutagenic, it is because of, among other tests, it has failed, if you will, the Ames test. What we have in the Ames test is a fairly simple Salmonella bacteria strain that in this particular strain has a histidine coding defect. What happens is that when dosed with a mutagenic chemical, that defect can change, and so that defect will allow cell division and growth. And so the histidine coding defect limits growth and development of this cell culture. So what to conduct the test, the Salmonella culture is added with a test chemical, and sometimes with rat hepatocytes. And why do we do that? Well, we've talked about this in terms of these rat hepatocytes allow for some level of metabolism. These are liver cells, so there is some biotransformation that occurs, so it allows to the analysis of the mutagenic properties of the parent chemical, but also the primary metabolites. Because the chemical will allow for mutations, and because of the rapid replication of bacteria, if in fact there is a mutation that corrects this histidine coating defect, you see substantial cell division and growth. And so here's a situation where the mutation has been a positive mutation in terms of the bacterial strain, from a limited growth potential to a significant growth potential. This slide is essentially a diagram of the sequence of events in carcinogenesis, our next topic of discussion. We can break this down because it is a very complex undertaking. People spend their careers studying cancer and carcinogenesis. We're going to give kind of in the next end of this particular lecture some introductory useful information about carcinogenesis that's important to understand in terms of your development of understanding of toxicology. Carcinogenesis is considered to be a multi-step, multifactorial disease. We typically have pro-carcinogen chemical. It may be non-reactive, so we may have a toxication to develop it into a carcinogen. This carcinogen has some level of interaction with DNA, and that can be a fairly wide range of interactions, as we've discussed. One of the paths can be that because we have this interaction, we have an immediate mutation. That mutation leads to uncontrolled cell growth and cancer. We can also have this interaction yielding a mutation, an initial stage of cancer. This initial stage is perhaps best termed as an initiator stage. And so the initiation happens, but it doesn't necessarily get promoted or go to the next stage in terms of development of cancer cells. So the multifactorial aspect is that you need not only an initiator, but you need a promoting agent that encourages the growth and development. For example, hormones of various types can have this promoting agent interaction. This promotion encourages cell growth. At some point it becomes uncontrollable and also leads to cancer. And again, the amount of information and research and scientific study we have on cancer has developed tremendous background in understanding how carcinogenesis happens. We don't necessarily have all of the answers, but we have a good idea on the disruption and the progression. And these, the more we know, have the ability to not only isolate carcinogenic chemicals, but also battle the disease once started. Next few slides, what we'll do is go through some cancer definitions. This just help you in terms of your reading and understanding of cancer. Several of us, I'm sure, have had cancer impact our own lives or through our families, loved ones, friends, and also just reading about individuals that have had the unfortunate diagnosis of cancer in their lifetime. Cancer is broadly defined as a malignant tumor that has the ability to metastasize or invade the surrounding tissues. We can also talk about cancer in terms of it being a tumor. These are typically neoplasm or neoplastic. It's a general term for uncontrolled growth of cells that become progressively worse in time. Some of these neoplasms can be slow-growing. They can also be tumors that are malignant or non-malignant. Neoplasia, this is just a simple term for the growth of new tissue with abnormal and unregulated cell proliferation. And so this whole regulation and control of cell growth and then cell death is an important part of the differentiation between normal cell biology and cancer cell biology. A benign tumor is a tumor that develops. It does not metastasize. We need to know what metastasize means. A metastasis is the ability to establish secondary tumor growth, typically at a new location. And so there is the ability for, in fact, single cells to migrate, for example, through the lymph system, which does transport particles and cells. And along the way, it lodges and starts developing this uncontrolled multiple growth. This is why, for example, in some metastasizing cancers, one of the first things they do, if it's a known type of cancer that metastasizes, they will do a complete CAT scan and try to locate via various dye uptakes, various chemical uptakes, whether this particular cancer has metastasized. There are critical organs that are involved in metastasis. And typically, I like to think of cancer, especially metastasizing cancer, as being a blockage chemical, a blockage cancer. These are cancers where the tissue itself gets so large it blocks significant function and blood flow to significant organs. It can take up or overconsume various building blocks, challenge particular normal function, and also with the development of pain, and finally succumbing to a significant amount of this uncontrolled cellular growth. You've probably heard the terms carcinoma and sarcoma. They are different terms. Carcinoma is a malignant tumor that arises in the epithelium, so these epithelial cells. So for example, we sometimes will deal with, for example, skin cells, epithelial cancer of the skin, like basal cell carcinoma. This is the most common form of cancer. We have a tremendous amount of epithelial cells in our lungs, in our gastrointestinal tract, and on our skin. We find that this usually spreads in the lymphatic system. Those of you that know about melanoma or the bad kind of skin cancer, not that any kind of skin cancer is good, the worst kind, that one of the key indicators of survivability is whether or not melanoma has entered the lymphatic system. If it has entered the lymphatic system, typically that is a bad indicator of outcome. Sarcoma is malignant tumor in muscle or connective tissue. For example, bone cancer is a sarcoma. It's usually spread in the bloodstream. Typically, it metastasizes to the lung. And so we find that the cancer itself, once metastasized, can impact critical organs. There's a dysfunction, for example, and we'll show you a slide here of kidney cancer. We've talked about kidney physiology and the importance of kidney physiology and the nephron function in terms of balancing fluids, balancing the molecules of life. Yes, we can do without kidneys in terms of having a single kidney or being on dialysis for some period of time. Typically, in early stage kidney cancer and even in advanced stage, kidney dysfunction is extremely common. Urinating blood or red urine is usually an indicator that the structural integrity of the kidney has been compromised due to this tumor growth. Well, in multistage carcinogenesis, we talked about this initiation step and then a promotion step. The initiation can be a chemical, it can be a virus, it can just be a spontaneous sort of mutation that occurs. There can be kind of some genetic defect there. It causes this DNA lesion. This DNA has the potential, because it's in a cell, to replicate and therefore propagate this particular lesion. This propagation is through cell division. There's no real outcome if it's not promoted. There are some chemicals that can initiate and also promote. And these initiated cells can remain indefinitely if not promoted. There are some estimates that our bodies have about 100,000 hits of cancer initiation each and every day. This doesn't have to do with necessarily environmental pollution or behaviors. It just happens because of the numbers and the potential for defects in all of the hundreds of thousands or billions of processes that are happening on a molecular basis in our bodies every day. There is a potential that this can be a one hit. There's no real threshold, and so we talked about this as being a non-threshold effect in dose response, because one chemical, one molecule of a chemical, one virus, can actually cause one cell to misdivide, to have this perpetuated DNA lesion. And once we have this lesion, we have the potential for this irreversible growth and development effect. Our immune system is pretty good at detecting cells that are misbehaving, so we have the ability to sort these out. And so there has been, for example, linkages between healthy immune system and the onset of cancer. And so this allows you to kind of consider overall health of the individual. Does cancer happen in apparently healthy individuals? The answer to that question is yes. Some of the properties of these initiated cells, there's no phenotypic differences. So one cell is exactly the same as the next one in cancer cells. They can be characterized by the coding defects of the cells, so there can be some excess or deficiency of critical enzyme or enzyme systems, glutathione transferase, glucose 6-phosphate, for example, an antioxidant. There can be iron exclusion, ATPase. All of these have some sort of potential expression in cancer cells. There is a resistance to cytotoxic chemicals that can have faster or slower metabolism in terms of oncology and cancer therapy. What chemotherapy tries to do is to use cytotoxic chemicals that exploit either the faster or slower metabolism of these particular cells versus their neighbor normal cells, differentiated cells. These initiated cells typically show impaired cellular communication. They have an enhanced response to growth factors, and they have a resistance to terminal differentiation, the cell apoptosis that essentially controls normal cell life. And so they typically have an array of differences, and this is a base cause in terms of the onset of cancer. In terms of the next step or the promotion in multistage carcinogenesis, what happens, this is these chemicals change the microenvironment of these initiated cells. They can be chemicals, these chemical viral spontaneous induced clonal proliferation of these initiated cells can actually have their growth control changed by various types of chemicals around them. These can be receptors, immune function modulators, endocrine control chemicals, communication chemicals, metabolic chemicals, and some of the apoptosis signaling chemicals in terms of chemotaxis. All of these can be changed. We're not going to go into specifics. Just note that these promotion chemicals essentially change the chemical environment around these initiated cells. Typically, when we talk about promotion chemicals, these aren't single hit. These typically are regarded as multi-hit, high-dose toxic interactions. Typically, they're found to be reversible, and they can be regarded as having a threshold-like effect, although the overall effect in terms of initiation and promotion is regarded as non-threshold. In terms of the progression, as we progress from these promoter chemicals, these cells demonstrate a complete loss of growth control. There's an instability in the karyotype, so we have chromosomal instability. There can be a gain or a loss of chromosomal fragments in some of these cells as they develop. There can be demethylation in terms of some of the base pairs and deregulation of various aspects of DNA replication. There can be gene amplification. We can find error-prone DNA repair. simply enough, most of these changes, because they are molecules of life changes, DNA changes, they are irreversible. Once they're on a track, they seem to have spontaneous continuity. We have the same mechanism in the progression as in promotion of the multi-stage cancer. We can take a look at carcinogenic chemicals and classify them as to their aspect of whether or not they are involved in initiation or in promotion of cancer. We can classify carcinogens, these chemical toxicants, as genotoxic. These genotoxic chemicals act directly on DNA or the expression of DNA during translation. They can induce DNA replication errors, point mutations, and some sort of chromosomal aberrations. We can also classify carcinogens as epigenetic. These are non-DNA reactive, and so if you were thinking of aflatoxin, you would think of it as a genotoxic chemical. Epigenetic chemicals are non-DNA reactive. They're potentiators. They challenge or change cell hormone or immune functions. They modify various processes or the chemical environment around these cells. In terms of genotoxic carcinogens, these chemicals are capable of producing cancer by directly altering the genetic material of these target cells. And so these are direct carcinogens, so these mustard gases, alkylating agents, they don't require metabolic activation, and so they are reactive in and of themselves. And so those sorts of chemicals that require no biotransformation are typically, that are carcinogens, are typically genotoxic carcinogens. There are also indirect carcinogens. They do require metabolic activation. We talked about PAHs, and we'll see it here in a moment, forming an epoxide. These epoxides form reactive free radicals. Aromatic amines, nitrosamines that occur in gut cancers, natural substances such as the mycotoxins we discussed, and various inorganic carcinogens, cadmium, chromium, nickel, arsenic among them. The whole driver, for example, in arsenic levels in drinking water is the development of bladder cancer and in some other cases lung cancer and various gut cancers associated with those municipalities, those environments where high arsenic levels occur in drinking water. For epigenetic carcinogens, these are cytotoxic carcinogens, and so some examples are NTA, nitrilotriacetic acid, or acetate. NTA was actually a chemical that was used in various laundry detergents until I believe it was banned approximately, I'd say, about 1990 or so. They were finding NTA out in environmental waters. Other cytotoxic carcinogens include BHA and BHA, butyl hydroxyaldehyde, butyl hydroxytoluene. These are called carcinogens because they are promoter chemicals. They are not carcinogenic in and of themselves, but they are carcinogenic when in a promotion environment. There are tumor promoters, DDT and dioxin. Our next lecture will talk about dioxin and its risk assessment. Various hormones, estradiol, diethylstilbestrol, DES. The book details an exceptionally significant, experiment gone wrong in terms of a pharmaceutical development and the use of DES in early term pregnancy to as a hormonal agent to manage discomfort in pregnant women. We also find that the various immunosuppressants like cyclosporin A, cyclosporin are epigenetic carcinogens. Cyclosporin A is a drug that is given to patients that are involved in tissue transplants, for example, a kidney transplant. Particulates as well can function as epigenetic carcinogens, for example, asbestos. I told you we would talk about the promotion aspect of PAH, carcinogenic activation. This is the bay region of a PAH, what we find is that it forms an epoxide. If we take a look at that, this epoxide goes to a diol. This diol epoxide, the next step is DNA reactive, so we can form from these PAHs DNA adducts that will cause have the potential to initiate DNA mutations. This is a partial list of proven human carcinogens, and typically when we have proven human carcinogens, we have the results from either occupational or environmental exposure. Obviously, we don't do cancer trials on humans. What we do is collect a sufficient amount of data, and quite often this data comes from, again, industrial or occupational or environmental exposures, sustained exposures. Some of the chemicals, and again, this is not a complete list, include aflatoxins, 4-aminobiphenyl, arsenic, benzene, benzidine, beryllium, bisechloroethyl ether, cadmium, chromium 6, which differentiates from chromium 4, which is abundant in the environment. Soot, mineral oils, mustard gas, naphthalamine, nickel, vinyl chloride, all of these known human carcinogen recognition. We can also link human carcinogenesis with substance abuse, alcoholism, and liver damage associated with alcoholism in its complete progression can lead to cancer. In some country, the chewing of betel nuts is associated with esophageal and oral cancers, cigarettes, and the well-known linkage between lung cancer. In terms of occupational exposure especially, dust and fibers such as asbestos, silica, and the development of silicosis. Soots, for example, the development that was observed over a century ago of various types of cancer in chimney sweeps in London was one of the first occupational exposure cancer linkages developed. Talcum or clay dusts, wood dusts, these are chemical irritants that yield potential for cancer. Cancer has also been linked to chronic infection. The H. pylori bacterium associated with stomach ulcers, both hepatitis B and C, and the chronic infection, liver infection associated with liver cancer, HIV, liver fukes, papillomavirus, with the wonderful news in the past 6 months or so of the development of a vaccine for papillomavirus, which has been linked to cervical cancer. Schistosomes, which are a waterborne parasite that can enter the human body and especially in unclean waters. There are some initiator chemicals that we do find in foods. Most of the genotoxic chemicals can be found in some trace variety just because of their presence in the environment. For example, trace levels of DDT and its metabolite DDE. The PAHs, like benzopyrene, that might develop from barbecuing meats. Various aromatic amines that might be used in or developed in various chemical food processes or preparations. Heterocyclic amines, mycotoxins from funguses that grow in normal natural infestations in certain types of climates, in certain types of grains such as corn, barley, wheat. Nitrosamines that form on the reaction of nitrites, sometimes used as food preservatives, with various amine groups that are available on proteins and peptides. Nitrosamines being another category of initiator chemicals that occur in food. Some of the promoting agents that can occur in food, BHT, saccharin, you can read the saccharin debates. Saccharin in and of itself is not an initiator chemical, but it is a promoter chemical. Cholic acid, TCDD, or tetrachlorodibenzodioxin, it's out there. It's out there in extraordinarily trace amounts in typical animal fat. It's a part of your diet. We'll talk about that in detail next lecture. And also alcohol, again, alcohol yielding cellular damage in the liver. This chart is useful. You'll hear terms such as human carcinogen, probable human carcinogen, possible, and various other types in terms of group A, group B1, group B2. Typically, if you're doing laboratory work and you're doing work with either group B or group A chemical, you're going to be doing that in a glove box or with a sufficient amount of personal protective gear on, whether it be masks or latex gloves, depending upon the particular type of chemical. If it's volatile, you'll probably be at least working in a hood, if not a glove box. The idea is that we've grouped carcinogens based on the amount of evidence, and this is a shifting designation in terms of a particular chemical as we get new knowledge. And so in terms of the risk assessment of a particular chemical, if, for example, there is an occupational exposure or a plethora of clinical cases of human carcinoma associated with a particular chemical exposure, it may, for example, be bumped up from probable to a known human carcinogen. It's good to kind of end this with just a general discussion of cancer. Cancer is a word that in and of itself is somewhat terrifying to most of us. A cancer diagnosis is extraordinarily unwelcome. What we find is that there is a tremendous amount of misrepresentation or misunderstanding of the causes of cancer and the occurrence of cancer in human population. As it turns out, when we do epidemiological analysis of the causes of cancer, we find out that our own behaviors are the principal linkages in terms of cancer. We tend to magnify risk that is given to us, for example, through the actions or activities of others, for example, things like air pollution or polluted water, when in fact it's our own behaviors that are the strongest linkage to cancer. These linkages include, in terms of epidemiological linkages, diet at 35% in terms of relationship, tobacco smoking 30%, sexual behavior 7% in terms of alcohol, about 3%, infection, 10%, occupational exposure is something that is one of those sorts of linkages of cancer that we tend to, because our jobs, we have an exposure. It doesn't dismiss or discount it, but at 4%, it's significantly lower than, for example, some of our elective behaviors. UV radiation, these are associated typically with skin cancers, associated with sunburn at 3%. There can also be a linkage between natural background or industrial levels or post-nuclear testing fallout at 3%. Pollution is regarded as a relatively small linkage in terms of the causes of cancer at 2%. In terms of the American Cancer Society's estimated U.S. cancer cases, in 2006, they are projecting that there will be about 1,400,000 cases of cancer. And these are diagnosed cases. These are extrapolated numbers based on previous years and growth in population and epidemiological statistical analysis. In men, there will be about 720,000 new cases of cancer. In women, about 680,000. If you look at the differentiation by gender, we find that about 33% of the cases in men will be prostate cancer, lung cancer, and bronchus cancer at 13%. Colon and rectal cancer at 10%. And then in single digits, urinary melanoma of the skin, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, kidney cancer, oral cavity cancer, leukemia, pancreas, and all of the sites at about 18%. In women, the dominant cancer diagnosis will be breast cancer at 31%, lung cancer at 12%, colorectal cancer at 11%, and also then in single digits, uterine, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, melanoma of the skin, thyroid cancer, ovarian cancer, and various other cancers. There is a differentiation according to gender, not only in estimated cancer, but also in the estimated cancer deaths. In the United States this year, about 291,000 men will die of cancer, and 273,000 will die as well. And so there is a difference in terms of exploring the impact of cancer on the U.S. population between diagnosis and survivability and also cancer deaths. When we look at that and compare it to the last slide in terms of diagnoses and the relationship of a cancer diagnosis with death from cancer, there is some differentiation. Obviously, in both of these slides, for men and women, lung cancer is the most significant cause of death at 31% of the cases for men and 26% in women. In colorectal cancer, about the next highest level for men is about 10%, whereas in women, as a cause of death, 15% for breast cancer. Prostate cancer is 9% for men, colorectal is 10% for women, and various others down here in terms of the relative association of cancer diagnosis and death in the U.S. population currently. And this has a lot to do with current therapeutics associated with the treatment of cancer and cancer diagnosis. One of the nice ways to kind of examine the role of cancer in our mortality is examining the epidemiological statistics for the lifetime probability of developing cancer for men. And this is an analysis of epidemiological data from the years 2000 to 2002. For all men, the risk of developing some sort of cancer is about 1 in 2. About half of us will develop cancer in our lifetime. Of that, the predominant cancer that we will be diagnosed with, one of six will be prostate cancer. 1 in 13 will get a diagnosis of lung cancer. Colorectal cancer is 1 in 17, and the rest of them being higher or less likely occurrences. In women, it's a little bit different. The development of cancer is significantly different from men. For all sites, women have a risk of 1 in 3. For breast cancer, women find that we find the epidemiological analysis that statistic is 1 in 8. So fairly similar in terms of prostate cancer, the 1 in 6 that we find for men. Lung and bronchus, 1 in 17, a little bit less than what men do, and this has a lot to do with elective behaviors, as we'll see here in a moment. Colorectal cancer, 1 in 18. And the rest of them in terms of some of the various probability of developing cancers in this particular epidemiological cohort. Let's examine just as an idea here one cancer, and we'll just kind of look at the development of colorectal cancer. We're not going to go through this necessarily on a cellular basis. We'll just do it from a macroscopic basis, again, to orient you on the small intestine, the colon, and the rectum in terms of your physiology. This is where it happens. Colorectal cancer starts with colon polyps. This is an actual micrograph from a sigmoidoscopy of what a colon polyp looks like. They recommend that as you hit your 40s, you start getting flexible sigmoidoscopy or other sorts of analyses to examine for the development of colon polyps. As it turns out, the development of polyps have some risk factors. If you're over 50, is a large risk factor, previous occurrence. So if you know that your parents have had a diagnosis of colon polyps, you probably have a significant chance of getting them. High-fat, low-fiber diets can lead to be linked with colon polyp development. Smoking, alcohol consumption, sedentary lifestyles, and being overweight all are risk factors for colon polyps. Colon polyps are the initial stage of colorectal cancer, and so if we stage this out from, in this case, stage 0, stage 1, 2, 3, and 4, what you can see is the relative invasive nature of the advance in staging of colorectal cancer. obviously with routine checkups, and they recommend sigmoidoscopies about once every 5 years. If you can catch colon polyps, these aberrations in stage one, there has been no proliferation in terms of linkages with the lymph nodes in the lymph circulation system. As we start getting into stage two and three, there is a potential for interaction and breakthrough in the mucosa and the outer lining of the intestines, and stage four, where we have a spread to other organs. These are some tissue photographs of what cancer looks like in autopsies from individuals. This is a kidney that has been removed. If you have a localized kidney cancer and it's caught early enough, golf ball stage or below, I would say, you probably have a 65% survival rate for the next 5 years. These are why any sort of abnormalities in your urine stream need to be checked out. What you can see, in fact, here now that we've done in this course several images of what a kidney looks like, you can see that the invasive nature of the cells, the uncontrolled growth, actually are systematically disruptive to all of the orchestrations of fluid flow, including blood flow and urine flow in this particular organ, and therefore leading to at least partial, if not complete, organ failure. In liver cancer, organ failure associated with cancer is lethal. You can see by the disposition of the coloring on this particular metastasized liver that in fact this liver is at least partially and almost perhaps in a majority non-functional. For the organ that controls the biosynthesis of most of the molecules of life in our body and synthesis of energy stores, this is a lethal impact. A non-lethal impact typically is basal cell carcinoma. This perhaps is a carcinoma that is uniquely avoidable by the use of sunscreens and avoidance of sunburn. Back in my days, it was very common in the early 60s to come home with a very red sunburn. It was before the development of the SPF, high SPF factor tanning lotions. My generation, especially fair-haired individuals, including myself, have a routine diagnosis of basal cell carcinoma from the amount of sun, depending upon our skin coloration, our genetics, and the amount of sun exposure we had with our typical behaviors, typically as children, but also as young adults. In terms of identifying, finishing off our lecture here today with the linkage of risk factors and carcinogenesis, there's many of them. You're aware of most of them just through public education, public health education impacts. What you may not know is that these behaviors and as well the tests and analysis of various things like your prostate-specific antigen or your breast analysis in your normal physicals do help catch cancer at an early stage when it is most treatable. Some of what we can do to avoid a diagnosis of cancer has to do with modifying behaviors. One of the behaviors that has had the most substantial linkage, epidemiological linkage, to the onset of cancer is tobacco use. Here the green line you can see, and this is a chart from 1900 to just beyond 2002. And in the green line, this is per capita cigarette consumption. You can see that it peaked in the mid-60s and started declining. This had a lot to do with the Surgeon General's linkage and the words that appear now on cigarette cartons in terms of linkages of lung cancer with tobacco use. In males on the blue line, you can see that there was a relationship between the decline of tobacco use and the decline of, these are age-adjusted lung cancer deaths. And so there was a decline in lung cancer deaths that parallels, coupled by about 10 or 20 years of difference there. This is also impacted by not only a decrease in tobacco use, but an increase in our ability to understand and diagnose and treat various types of cancer. What's interesting also is the development of female lung cancer death rate changes historically as well. I always like to talk about the advertisements that started occurring in the late 60s and early 70s, encouraging women to smoke as a way to express their individuality. I recall the Virginia Slims advertisements, one type brand of cigarettes, you've come a long way, baby. And you certainly have in terms of cigarette smoking and the impact of that in terms of female lung cancer death rates. At this point in time, there was a significant difference in male and female associated with the general social acceptability of women smoking. Women were encouraged in advertisements to smoke as an expression of their independence, so they responded to that advertising, one would say. Their independence also led to an enhanced death rate from tobacco use. So you can see an offset in terms of the peaking here because of the social stigma that was released from women smoking cigarettes. There are other aspects in terms of risk factors. Several of these are associated with physical activity, routine screening exams at your physicals, self-examination, and just being kind of smart about occupational exposure and personal exposure to things that may damage cells, whether it be chemicals, viruses, and other sorts of behaviors, all things in moderation. The American Cancer Society actually recommends that individuals eat 5 or more servings of fruit and vegetables on a daily basis for cancer prevention. And this has a lot to do with what we talked about during our target organ toxicity discussion of oxidative stress and the incorporation of especially plant-based food antioxidants in your diet. We have come a long way in terms of recognizing the importance of consumption, but we have pretty much plateaued. If you look at 1994 to 2003 demographics, these are bar graphs of trends in consumption of 5 or more vegetables or fruits for cancer prevention, and this is adults 18 years and older. The prevalence in terms of percent is pretty static, starting here at 24, about a quarter of the people in the U.S. adults actually behave, so to speak, dietarily. This probably is not statistically significant, but it is perhaps discouraging that most recent data here, 23.6%, shows about a 1% decrease over some of the previous years in terms of adults that are actually consuming the recommended fruit and vegetable servings. So diet, personal behaviors, all of those manage some of the initial sorts of causation linkages, risk factors, if you will, associated with carcinogenesis. So what we've done today is a substantially ambitious undertaking, a dense lecture, if you will, in the amount of information. So perhaps you'll have to review the notes several times, but hopefully with your advanced reading, many of the terms, many of the concepts, as well as your prior study of biology, has set you up for an analysis of some of the impacts of toxicology that lead to these changes, some of them heritable changes on the molecules of life. Next time what we're going to do is we're going to talk about dioxins and these related chlorinated hydrocarbon compounds. They exist out in the environment in the human food chain and their relationship to human toxicology. Until that time, we'll see you again. Thanks.